Bert Cohen here. Welcome to Portside. Well, we are a nation of laws, aren't we? Laws really matter in our domestic policy and in our foreign policy. The people of America care very much about law. Bert Cohen here. Thanks for tuning in to Portside. I think you'll find an interesting show today. We'll talk about laws that may have been violated during the Israeli war in Gaza that lasted 22 days. From December 27th to January 18th, Israeli forces killed more than 1,400 Palestinians, including at least 288 children, over 5,300 injured, of which at least 1,600 were children. The majority of those killed in that war were, in fact, civilians. 2 weeks after Israel declared a unilateral ceasefire, a National Lawyers Guild delegation of seven attorneys and one law student traveled to Gaza to investigate the circumstances that led to these massive Palestinian casualties and to determine what, if any, violations of international law occurred and whether U.S. domestic law was violated as a consequence. And I'm very pleased to have with us Huwaida Araf, who from the National Lawyers Guild. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
She received her Juris Doctor from American University at Washington College of Law, where she focused on international human rights and humanitarian law. And prior to becoming a lawyer, she spent 4 years in the West Bank training and coordinating volunteers to monitor and report human rights abuses, as well as organizing international campaigns against arbitrary detention, home demolitions, movement restrictions, and violence against civilians. Ms. Araf co-founded International Solidarity Movement, which has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And, well, first, perhaps you can tell us what the National Lawyers Guild is, and how did this preliminary investigation come about, and who was involved? What was it like?
Well, the National Lawyers Guild is a national organization. It's one of the oldest and largest lawyers delegations. It was actually legal institutions. It was founded. It was one of the first, also integrated. Was the first integrated legal associations back when African Americans allowed into national organizations and weren't represented by the American Bar Association. And this delegation came about basically a few of us communicating during Israel's onslaught on Gaza, figuring that we should try to do something. And from there, kind of starting to organize how we could arrange to get into the Gaza Strip, because from the media, mainly the international media, not so much the U.S. media, we were seeing a lot of reports about violations of international humanitarian law, war crimes that were possibly committed. And we knew as lawyers that there's a lot more analysis that has to go into actually assessing whether there were violations of international law, and specifically if these violations amount to war crimes, but also knew that if there was evidence that we should also try to do our part to make sure that these the people responsible are held accountable, because we are advocates of law, the rule of law, and especially when it comes to human rights, because that's kind of the very basic. If you don't have basic rights guaranteed to human beings by virtue of being a human being, and it's respect to life, dignity, property, then what do you have? And then if you have people violating these and not being held accountable, then there really isn't any kind of there won't be any future respect for the law or need to have these. And so we felt that as lawyers, and specifically as American lawyers, because the U.S. government gives so much aid to, in the form of weapons, to the Israeli government, that we should try to do what we can.
Now, did you, when you were there, was it specifically to look into potential violations of international law on both sides, or just by the government of Israel?
Well, we specifically went to look at how Israel conducted its operations. Now, we also realized that on the Palestinian side, that there also could have been violations of international humanitarian law on that level. However, two things. There are, we hear constantly in the United States about how Palestinians and Hamas are terrorists and are violent. And so that kind of always comes out, a lot of times inaccurately, but there is a lack of information and a lack of realization also what kind of violence is committed on the Israeli side. And also the discrepancy was tremendous, over 1,400 killed Palestinians killed, and most of these, almost 1,000 of them, civilians. And on the Israeli side, 13 Israelis killed, 10 of which were soldiers, and 4 of those soldiers were killed by friendly fire. So there's a massive discrepancy, and so that there was more of an urgent need to look at how really Israel conducted its operations. Also, again, being American lawyers, we have that U.S. Component, in that the U.S. supports Israel, various kinds of aid, but also specifically we looked at and we were concerned with U.S. military aid to Israel. The U.S. does not provide the same kind of aid to the Palestinian side, certainly not any kind of military aid, and certainly also nothing to the Hamas government, which is currently in control in Gaza.
Well, it sounds like it's an interesting point about 13 Israelis were killed, and quite a few of those by friendly fire, which does happen in a war situation. And that it sounds like the interesting point may be that you, as Americans, the National Lawyers Guild delegation, America, you know, has been supporting the Israeli government for quite some time with all kinds of resources, and therefore it's, I think an argument could be made that it's more important for us to investigate were any of our American laws violated, and you know, violations that may have happened. And it's in our interest as Americans to make sure that that our aid doesn't violate international law. Is there any possibility that there may have been violations of United States requirements, conditions that are put on the United States puts on conditions for the receipt of military assistance? Is it possible that, and I guess it's a part of the Arms Export Control Act to make sure that there are conditions and that those are not violated. So therefore, it seems rather logical to investigate those that received our aid and check it out and see what can be done from that. So there were 2 weeks after the Israeli ceasefire. Who all went? How did this group get selected from the National Lawyers Guild?
Well, it was mainly coordinated over the internet. It was myself who contacted an old colleague that was also a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and we started discussing, and then put out a call over the National Lawyers Guild listserv announcing our intentions and asking for applications of people that would be interested in going. However, it was organized all in about a week's time, so we literally expected people to drop what they were doing, leave their jobs, and buy a plane ticket to Egypt. And we did find there were a total of 8 of us that were willing and available to do that. There were a lot more that expressed interest, but again, because this was done so quickly, some people had, you know, obligations to existing clients or court dates or things that they could not maneuver around. And so in the end could not come. But at the same time, we also wanted to keep the delegation small so that we could move around easily. And the situation at the time, getting into Gaza, was also not easy. Israel completely controls Gaza by air, sea, and land. However, there is a border with Egypt, which Israel indirectly monitors, but we could go through Egypt for that one because Israel wasn't letting anybody else in from any other way. And for a brief time, Egypt announced that it was going to open the border with Gaza. Mm-hmm. It's called the Rafah Crossing. And they opened that under pressure, getting so much pressure because the humanitarian crisis that was taking place in Gaza was so severe, and the people were literally caged in. They had nowhere to go. This is also another element of which we did not discuss too much in the report, but it is really another serious element of the way that Israel conducted its operations and its offensive in Gaza, and that it didn't. It was a small area of land, very crowded, 1.5 million people in 140 miles square in land area. So very crowded, and they're being bombarded, and they have nowhere to flee. Literally all the borders were closed, so they could not flee. But Egypt did open their border for a little while to allow the most severe medical cases to exit and to allow some humanitarian aid in. That was almost completely prevented or non-existent before that, because Israel also severely restricts what comes in, even by way of the United Nations. But when they opened that border, they were letting some humanitarian workers in and some journalists, because they were getting criticism, and Israel was also heavily criticized by journalists for trying to create a blackout inside Gaza, because foreign journalists weren't getting in. But more importantly, and for humanitarian purposes, well, actually, it could be argued what's more important, for the news to get out or for the medical aid to be able to get in and out in order to create the kind of action that you want to create, because you have to get information out in order to mobilize people to take action. But it was that window that we used to get in. We did not announce that we were a delegation of lawyers. We also had other associations that we were affiliated with. Myself, I went on behalf of another human rights and humanitarian organization, a U.S.-based organization that does humanitarian work in Gaza. I sit on the board of that organization. I was sent as a representative and therefore was able to get in as a humanitarian worker. And some of my colleagues that went with me were commissioned by different news and media outlets to go and collect information for them, and so we're able to get in that way.
Well, a couple of questions here. I wanted to find out how you collected the information, how verifiable it was, because, you know, some of the charges are fairly strong, serious charges, and what were some of the specific violations that you found?
Sure. There was so much, but we decided to concentrate the limited time that we have to looking at three areas. The first area is the targeting of civilians and civilian infrastructure. The second area being the misuse of weapons. And the third being the blocking of humanitarian and medical aid to the injured. And again, there's so much more that we could have looked at, but we had such limited time. We were only in Gaza for 6 days, and we wanted to look at really kind of the most extreme violations. All of the above that I named are violations of international law, and some of them can amount to war crimes. And so what we mainly looked at, or how we went about our investigation was, it was almost all of our evidence was collected from firsthand interviews. Basically, we did meet with some organizations, but just to get a more broad overview and to get a little bit of direction, because there were so many victims, but we were looking in at those three areas that I identified, and so we wanted to be pointed to the areas or to the people that could tell us about some of these cases, if and how they occurred. And we got a lot more people giving us a lot more information about, again, other violations, but ones that we did not look at. For example, there were quite a few instances of people, civilians, children, being hit by missiles while they were in the street riding bikes, playing here or there, and apparently being directly fired at by, you know, by an F-16, by a drone missile from an aerial, from an aircraft. Though this wasn't, again, this should also be investigated. However, it would be hard for us to say this was a deliberate targeting of a civilian here, because there could have been other things going on that we did not, could not get information on. And we recognize that a weak point in our investigation is that we did not get to speak to Israeli soldiers. And so there's another side, but we firmly believe that if we collect enough evidence that a violation is committed, this should at least go towards saying that there needs to be a more thorough independent investigation of what's happening. So when I say that we looked at the deliberate targeting of civilians, I'll give you an example of a couple of the cases. One of them, we interviewed a young man, Khaled Abd Rabbo, who's 32 years old, who told us how he was in home with his family and extended family of about 40 persons when he noticed that three Israeli tanks had rolled into his neighborhood and stationed themselves near his home. One tank was only about 10 meters from his home, and then he heard soldiers yelling for everyone to come out of the house. Now, he exited his home with his wife, his elderly mother, and three young daughters. One was 7, one was 4, and one was 2 years old. And between them, they carried 4 white flags, and they slowly came out of the house and stood in front of this tank. He estimates about 5 to 7 minutes they were standing in front of this tank, waiting for the soldiers to tell them to do something, either to go back in the house or to walk a certain direction. He says that he noticed two of the soldiers outside of the tank. One was eating chips, one was eating chocolate, indicating what, that they weren't engaged in active fighting. They didn't perceive a threat to their life if they were kind of relaxed eating chips and chocolate and outside of their tank. And they're looking at this family standing in front of them, when all of a sudden a third soldier comes out of the tank and opens fire on his children. His 7-year-old and 2-year-old daughter were immediately killed. His 4-year-old daughter, Samar, survived, but is paralyzed. She's currently receiving treatment in Belgium. She sustained bullet wounds to the chest, and so they went out to her back, and her spine was hit. She would probably be paralyzed for life. His mother was also injured, but again, survived. So this is, I don't know what the soldiers might say, but they're really, it's very hard to come up with any other, with any justification for how these civilians and young children standing in front of these soldiers for at least 5 to 7 minutes carrying white flags a short distance, and a soldier opens fire on them when there was no other fighting in the area. And, you know, sadly enough, there were a number of cases like this where, you know, there couldn't have been many other explanations. But for every case that we documented, there are hundreds more that still need to be, that are being documented by current human rights workers in Gaza, but they need to be investigated. That was targeting of civilians. Civilian infrastructure, almost the same thing. We looked at clearly defined civilian infrastructures and what could have been, and by taking eyewitness testimony, what could have been going on in the area, what the attack, how the attack was carried out. For example, a school, the American International School in Gaza. This is one of the only institutions in Gaza that provides a Western-style education. It's a co-ed institution. the people that built it very proud of their school and the type of education that they provided for the children in Gaza. This school, in the middle of the night, was hit with two F-16 missiles. No other, according to eyewitnesses, no other fighting was going on in the area. Nothing else in the area was hit. And according to the director of the school, to the best of his knowledge, their grounds, the grounds of the school, was never used for any kind of, it was never used by any, by Palestinian militants. So wasn't used for firing anything at the Israelis. And even the location, would it would not really make sense for Palestinian militants to use the grounds of the school if they were going to do that. And so this was the only thing in the area that was hit, a direct hit by two F-16 missiles, and no kind of evidence whatsoever that the school was being used for military purposes.
Well, what about
other cases like that?
What about, well, you're listening to Bert Cohen, Portside, and we're talking with Huwaida Araf, who was with the National Lawyers Guild that went on a fact-finding delegation to Gaza in February 2009. We're talking about what they found in their recently issued report. Now, one goes back to Vietnam, where there was the My Lai massacre, and questions were raised that where a lot of civilians, unarmed civilians, were deliberately targeted and deliberately killed. And a few soldiers paid the price for that. And the question was raised, was it just aberrant, law-breaking individuals who need to be investigated and, if you know, put on trial? Or was it policy? That was the question back during Vietnam. And certainly Cali was targeted back then as the American, and it looked like they just blamed him, Lieutenant Cali, for this massacre in the small village of My Lai. And that was the end of the story. A lot of other American soldiers came forth in the Winter Soldier hearings back in 1971 in Detroit to say that, no, it wasn't. This wasn't an aberration. There was a lot of it going on. And I wonder, do you have indications that it was just out of control individuals? You know, war is scary. Sometimes people get scared and overreact. Or could it have been, you know, targeting young children as unarmed civilians? Could it have been actual policy? Do you have any indication one way or the other?
Well, actually, I think the strongest indication right now is being provided or is coming out from Israeli soldiers themselves. This isn't something that, you know, we didn't get to talk to Israeli soldiers, but recently, over the past few weeks, there have been reports saying that soldiers are coming clean with their discomfort about how they were asked to carry out their operations in Gaza. And I think that more of that will come out, and that needs to be investigated. And there are other also disturbing elements that, not part of the evidence that we collected firsthand, but all go to policy and intent. And this is all coming out from either Israeli soldiers themselves or statements made by Israeli officials. One of the soldiers in something that was documented in the Israeli papers has talked about the role of the Jewish rabbinate in Gaza, in Israel, but the role that they played in this offensive, and how that they were on hand in passing out their literature to the soldiers and talking about how they need to, basically how they need to fight this war and get rid of the infidels, and this is the Jewish land. And we so really dehumanizing in their religious literature, making it seem to the soldiers that this is a religious war and dehumanizing the other. That we did not discuss in our report, again, because it wasn't firsthand information from us, but that very much goes to policy, goes and will go to intent in proving war crimes and a lot of the violations that we documented. So, again, that is a very, very important point that you raised, and I think that needs to come out. But in the limited time that we had and the access that we had, we also, it's not that we didn't want to go in and talk to Israeli soldiers, but we didn't have the access to do that. And also the way that we entered Gaza through Rafah, it isn't as if we would not have been able to enter through Israel and going through the Erez crossing that to Gaza. And so, again, for many different reasons, our access was limited. But this is also why in our report we're calling for a more comprehensive investigation. And the UN Human Rights Council has appointed a delegation, a council, to conduct this very kind of investigation, which we are hoping that the Israeli government does cooperate with, although they've already kind of made statements to the effect that they might not cooperate with this, but the U.S. government really should put pressure on Israel to cooperate. Israel cannot continue to just disregard the United Nations, disregard international law, and to refuse for anybody to look into its conduct. Now, the Israeli military, the soldier testimonies that I mentioned, the Israeli military said that the day that this broke in the media, it did get a significant amount of attention, and so after the reports came out, the Israeli military announced that it will investigate, probably because it got media attention and they couldn't seem like they were ignoring it. They announced that they will investigate. But a week ago, they announced that they have closed the investigation, that they found no violations, and that these stories of soldier testimonies were fabricated. We really don't believe that Israel will, unfortunately, conduct a serious investigation into the conduct of their soldiers, and more than that, really into, as you said, whether or not this was policy coming not only from the military officials, but also from political officials, because there were some disturbing statements that came out there also to the effect that they will use disproportionate force, which is prohibited under international law, under the laws of war, to use disproportionate force to achieve your military objectives. But you have Israeli political officials clearly saying, we will use disproportionate force to teach them a lesson. That is covered in our report.
Well, it's also true that Ehud Olmert, I think, is a defense minister, I'm not sure of the correct title, but said right at the very beginning of the war that we will hit them a lot harder than they hit us, and a clearly disproportionate response. I mean, they're just open about that they would do that.
And that's true. Sorry to cut you off, but what's also true about Ehud Olmert, who is the Minister of Defense, he did make that statement. And at the same time, one of the Israel was saying that in justifying the need for launching this military offensive, they pointed to the rockets, the homemade rockets that Hamas was firing into Israel. And yet you have this Minister of Defense, Ehud Olmert, also saying that they had a ceasefire with Hamas. They had a ceasefire agreement that was very effective in reducing the rockets fired into Israel. And therefore, if that was their justification, if the purpose was just to reduce or to end the rockets that Hamas was firing into Israel, they could have done it by just renewing the ceasefire with Hamas, which Hamas offered to do and Israel rejected. So Israel rejected the renewal of this ceasefire and decided instead to launch its offensive, which led to the death of so many innocent civilians.
Well, I have to say, I was last night, as a matter of fact, where this show is originating in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Nadav Tamir, Israeli Consul General for New England, was there. And he has said, and Israel has said over and over and over again, that Hamas was not living by the ceasefire, that they had constantly violated the ceasefire. So they're saying that, and that was the justification, and to them, a requirement that they, whack the heck out of Hamas there, that they said that they had been bombarded by rockets, that they had to do something. I mean, what would we do if our homes were being targeted by Hamas rockets? We'd want to do something.
I mean, it is legitimate to say, sure, we should do something. But again, that's something that they did in negotiating a ceasefire with Hamas. According to Israel's own website and its own officials, that ceasefire was working. The months after the ceasefire was signed, it was signed June 19th, 2008, and then July, you saw a dramatic drop. July, August, September, and October, in the number of rockets fired by Hamas into Israel down to, at one point, just one rocket, and, you know, that injured nobody. And so it was, again, according to Israeli sources themselves, it was extremely effective. But then on November 4th, while the ceasefire was in place, Israel breached the ceasefire by launching an attack on Hamas members in Gaza, killing six members of Hamas, which caused Hamas to retaliate and to fire back rockets at Israel. But then in December, they were talking about renewing the ceasefire, and that's a statement I mentioned by Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak that said that if they were concerned, if they wanted to just stop the fire, the rocket fire into Israel, they would have accepted to renew the ceasefire. And this is, again, Israeli sources, not my own.
And certainly,
self defense is. There's also another element when you're looking at international law that is kind of ignored in this country and by Israel when you're talking about the situation that occurred in Gaza. But it may be worthwhile to mention here briefly. Gaza is occupied territory. It's occupied by Israel. Israel controls all access to Gaza by air, sea, and land. The movement of the people, and many other factors that puts it in effective control of this small territory. And so under international law, Israel has obligations to the Palestinians living in Gaza, has an obligation to their well-being, which it has been violating in the months even before they launched their attack, by severely limiting the amount of food and medicine that gets into Gaza, by restricting people's movement over the past 2 years, even before the offensive. Over 260 Palestinians died in Gaza just as a result of not being able to get the medical attention they needed, either because Israel restricted the entry of certain medicines into the Gaza Strip or did not let these people out of Gaza, whether into Israel or to other third countries, to receive the kind of treatment that they needed that wasn't available in the Gaza Strip. They restricted fuel and electricity, cutting off electricity to the Gaza Strip, cutting off their fuel, which means that their ambulances can't run efficiently, which means that they can't purify their water, can't run the pumps. And so you had a lot of problems being caused in Gaza as a result of this kind of total control over this strip and the violation of the people's rights that live in there. And then you go and launch a massive military attack. When you are responsible, when you're an occupying power, you can't besiege or launch a war on the people that you're occupying. And so the whole self-defense argument in there comes into question when you're looking at Israel's conduct under international law. Probably a very kind of sophisticated legal argument to get into here, but that is something that's also very important. So what you have when you look at the overall picture is a small, overcrowded area of land that is totally under Israel's control, that Israel has been severely restricting food, medicine, and other things into the Gaza Strip, so severely weakened the population and its ability to even respond to the massive military attack that Israel launched at that time. And you do have an element inside Gaza that is firing homemade rockets at Israel, claiming to be fighting for their liberation from Israeli occupation. Whether or not, depending on what way you look at that, you have a situation where Israel launched what is looking like, and in fact, what the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied territories has said probably amounts to a crime of aggression, a crime against peace. Something we do not look at our report, but should be looked at in the overall context. And certainly also by our politicians when we're talking about what America is going to do to promote peace in the Middle East. This is something that we cannot ignore.
There's a lot to talk about. Certainly, I want to make sure we talk about America's response before the end of the show. Bert Cohen here on Portside, talking with Hawaida Araf about National Lawyers Guild, what they found. And we're talking about not so much policy, right and wrong, but, well, actually right and wrong when it comes to violations of international law. We're talking about the legal aspects of the operation in Gaza that happened just after Christmas and right before Barack Obama became president. And you talked about medicine. I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that denial of medical access to the wounded is a violation of international law. Now, Israel allowed three-hour breaks in the war after a few days. Couldn't medical help get in there? And are there specific incidents of denial of medical access to the wounded?
Yes, that is one of the three areas that we looked at. International law imposes an obligation on both parties to a conflict to allow medical aid and medical assistance to the people that need it. The wounded are considered protected persons. So even if it was a fighter, even if it was, you know, someone from the opposing side that's actively fighting you that is now wounded, you have an obligation as one of the parties to the conflict to allow medical assistance to reach that wounded fighter. And suddenly this person that is wounded, you know, even if he was fighting before, is no longer a legitimate military target. So, for example, if a soldier from the other side is wounded and is down, you can't go and kill him or her. You are obligated to allow medical assistance to get to him or her, or if there isn't medical assistance from their side, to provide medical assistance yourself. And that dates back to not only the Fourth Geneva Conventions and the 1907 Hague regulations on the laws of war, but even before that, it's called customary international law. It's something that is customary international law is obligatory basically on everyone. Even if you're not signatory to a particular convention or a particular treaty, it is applicable to, sure, to everybody to abide by these. Now, what we found is that we didn't even actually look at whether there were instances of wounded Palestinian fighters that did not get the needed medical attention. We focused on civilians and found more than enough evidence that civilians were routinely denied access to medical care, either deliberately or arbitrarily. When I say arbitrarily, it's understandable. International law recognizes that sometimes a party, a warring side, cannot let medical ambulances into an area for security or other reasons. But this decision needs to be regularly revisited and the needed medical assistance provided as soon as possible. So arbitrary denial of access is also a violation of international law. There are many things I can tell you here. One of the most egregious instances we found is an attack on a Palestinian neighborhood called Al Zaytun neighborhood. The Israeli military did not let any kind of medical assistance come into this area until at least the fourth day of its military operation, after it had demolished dozens of homes and injured hundreds of civilians. And then there were reports of civilians dead in the area. People, civilians, men, women, and children buried under the rubble of their homes. The Red Crescent reported to us that they had received over 145 calls for help from this area and could not get in. They were coordinating through the Red Cross, trying to coordinate with the Israeli military, and they were not able to get in. Until the fourth day, Israel did allow a three-hour ceasefire that you mentioned and allowed paramedics to come into the area. Now, they let the paramedics in, but did not let them bring in their ambulances. They were forced to park their ambulances 2 kilometers away from this neighborhood and enter on foot. So when you have the massive amount of devastation that you have in this area, hundreds of injured and I don't know how many killed, to not be able to bring in your ambulances to evacuate these injured becomes a problem, and you have also less than 3 hours to work. So what the medical workers told us is they were forced to get donkey carts and pile the wounded on donkey carts and then have the medical workers pull these donkey carts 2 kilometers to the ambulances. And because they had such a short amount of time, they could not even worry about the people that they knew were already dead. They only had to, they had to focus on the people that were still alive and injured and they thought that they could save. And after that 3 hour time was up, the Israeli forces started firing at these ambulances so they could make them leave the area. This is This is documented in our report and other instances. We know at least 15 medical workers that were killed and over and 21 injured in the course of carrying out their medical duties. Ambulances fired at. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to tell where these ambulances directly targeted the ones that were fired at, but we also have eyewitness reports of ambulances that were deliberately crushed. They were parked in front of a medical center, and Israeli tanks rolled over these ambulances with their tanks. We have another report of three mobile clinics that were directly targeted. Three missiles hit these mobile clinics while they were parked in the vicinity of a clinic. Again, that was not, there was nothing going on in the area, no fighters anywhere near the mobile clinics or this clinic and many other hospitals and medical centers that were hit. So medical personnel and medical vehicles and clinics were hit.
Right.
And at the same time, people that needed medical attention were denied it. Which caused them unnecessary suffering and death in many cases.
Well, I mentioned that Nadav Tamir, Israeli Consul General from New England, I had a chance to ask him a couple questions last night, and I would think that if there were these violations of international law, they would want to go after that. And I asked him specifically if Israel was open to cooperating with a United Nations investigation, which has, I guess, a judge has been appointed, a prominent South African judge, Richard Goldstone. And I asked him about that. Would they cooperate? And his answer was that the United Nations Human Rights Commission was not so much about human rights, but was basically instead a mouthpiece for Iran, Libya, and other nations that don't like Israel. And his answer basically was that Israel can investigate these charges themselves. They don't need the UN to do it, and will probably not. He couldn't speak for the government per se, but he did say that they would probably not cooperate. Can't Israel just investigate this themselves?
Wow. That is quite an accusation. I mean, against the whole UN body, the Human Rights Council, and the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories is a renowned international law expert, Professor Richard Falk, who is actually Jewish himself, but is heavily criticized by Israel and has been denied from actually entering Israel in the Occupied Territories to do his work because Israel considers him biased. That's really what happens. Anytime anyone has legitimate criticism against Israel's policies, they're considered biased, and Israel decides it doesn't want to cooperate. This is a problem. We can't allow that as members of the international community, and certainly as Americans who provide all of this support for Israel, we can't allow Israel to continue to just turn its back on international law and the international community like this. One would think that Israel should be able to conduct an investigation. However, if they're going to come out and say, no, there weren't any violations, when there's clear evidence that there were, then we can't take this kind of investigation seriously. And the Israeli government has already announced that it will do all it can to protect its soldiers from any kind of accusation or prosecution.
Wow.
And so there isn't any kind of indication that Israel will carry out a legitimate investigation. Now, when we talk about jurisdiction to prosecute violations of international law and war crimes, primary jurisdiction should fall on the country itself. If Israel is able and willing to prosecute, then the international community leaves it to Israel to prosecute. But if Israel is either not able or not willing to faithfully prosecute these things, then it is incumbent on the international community to take action, because otherwise international law is a joke and we're letting these human rights abusers and possibly war criminals get away with the kind of actions that I have described here. So there isn't any kind of indication that Israel will prosecute. And actually, just so it's not confused, let me say there's a difference between prosecution and actual investigation. Israel can conduct its own investigation, but this should not be any kind of block or excuse to say that there is no need for an international investigation. And when the international community also says that here are the violations and here are people that we think should be prosecuted, then if Israel is willing and able to prosecute them, then the international community doesn't need to worry about it. But if Israel is not willing or able, then we need to find an alternate form. And one of the things that has been brought up is for the United Nations to create a tribunal to look into these violations and to prosecute violators. And that is something that actually the National Lawyers Guild has gotten behind, a tribunal to prosecute Israeli war crimes.
Well, I noticed that the war on Gaza ended precisely 2 days before Barack Obama became president. I'm sure that was just coincidence. What should the Obama administration do about the allegations that have come out of this investigation by the National Lawyers Guild? And why would it be in American interest? You know, how do our laws get involved in this? And what is American responsibility to look into this these allegations?
Well, the United States government has a number of restrictions in place, conditions that are placed on for U.S. assistance. One of these is the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, which places restrictions on the use of American weaponry that is delivered abroad. And that law restricts foreign assistance by the U.S. to the government of any country that is engaging or that engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Then there's also the Arms Export Control Act that it places more specific restrictions on what U.S. weaponry and foreign assistance can be used for. One of these is internal security. The second is legitimate self-defense. The third is to permit this foreign country to participate in regional or collective arrangements consistent with the UN Charter. And the fourth is to, which doesn't really apply to Israel, but to assist undeveloped friendly foreign countries to develop public infrastructure. These are enumerated by the Arms Export Control Act in order to try to ensure that the Foreign Assistance Act is respected and that the U.S. is not delivering arms to a country that engages in frequent and regular abuses of human rights. Now, the whole self-defense argument that you mentioned and that we talked about briefly towards the beginning of your show would kind of go towards looking at this. Was Israel really acting for internal security or legitimate self-defense? And there are a lot of indications that no, this is not the case, and so this is these two laws are implicated. But also, the Arms Export Control Act and the provisions of it do not only apply to the overall conduct. For example, whether Israel's overall offensive in Gaza was for internal security or legitimate self-defense, but also the individual, the specific operations. For example, was U.S.-supplied white phosphorus used in an illegal method in a way that had nothing to do with legitimate self-defense? And in our report, we document that this is indeed the case, but does Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, two other U.S.-based human rights organizations, found evidence and document evidence of this. So there is a lot of evidence that exists to show that Israel used U.S.-supplied weapons in a way that is prohibited by, the provisions of, our own U.S. laws, and therefore an investigation needs to be launched, lest the U.S. government be supporting, again, a government that is engaged in human rights abuses. So the National Lawyers Guild has issued some recommendations in its report. The first one is for support of an independent, thorough investigation like the one commissioned by the UN Human Rights Council. And we think that the U.S. should fully back that UN investigation. So if Israel decides that it's not going to cooperate, then there needs to be pressure from the United States on Israel to cooperate with that. At the same time, the Obama administration should look into violations of the Foreign Assistance Act and the U.S. Arms Export Control Act. And until the results of such an investigation by the U.S. government is made public and the violations that are committed are known and certain safeguards are in place to prevent future violations, the U.S. needs to stop arms shipment to Israel, because right now there's overwhelming evidence that there are violations. And so until there is a clear investigation and we know the results of those investigations, the U.S. should not continue to ship arms to Israel.
Has there been any reaction from the Hillary Clinton Department of State? Certainly they, I think, would have an interest in this. What has been their reaction, and what do you expect to be the reaction from the Obama administration and more specifically the Department of State?
Well, we have not heard anything yet from our report. Just came out this past week, and we plan to have meetings with members of Congress. We plan to try to arrange a meeting with State Department officials and also the U.S. representative to the U.N., Susan Rice, about our findings and what the position of the U.S. government should be. So as a reaction to our report, yet we have not heard anything from the administration, but we are also going to take a more proactive role in scheduling meetings with concerned individuals in order to be able to push for action. And I'll let you know what their response is.
Uh-huh. Well, Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Hawaida Araf about the very recent National Lawyers Guild fact-finding delegation in Gaza to see what happened there. What are the implications if these crimes, alleged crimes, are not investigated?
Well, I think it would be a very clear and unfortunate message to people all around the world that international law can be violated and there is no recourse. And so if we want to look at practically, this is something actually that the UN Deputy Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, Mr. John Genghis in Gaza, he said this: if we can't show the Palestinian people that there is the rule of law, there's international law, and violators will be prosecuted, then what can you say against, you know, the people that the Obama administration, that the world is claiming to fight, people that violate the law or terrorists? I mean, if you can't show people that violation of the laws and of their human rights will be sought out and prosecuted by the international community, then there's no reason for them to kind of have faith in the rule of law. And therefore, they're going to do whatever they can in order to try to protect themselves, even if it is supporting Hamas fighters that fire rockets into Israel in order to fight for their freedom. So therefore, it's a very dangerous message to be sending, in that certain people can get away with these kinds of violations. If we expect, as a community of nations to be united in the support and defense of human rights, then people that violate them need to be prosecuted. That's on a large level. If we look at specifically the United States, and you think also with this new incoming administration, with President Obama, that is very concerned about fixing the image of the United States abroad, for presenting the United States not as a hypocritical government that turns a blind eye to some violations and then just is rhetorical about terrorism and the need to fight this war on terror, on the other hand, then the Obama administration needs to show that it is serious about upholding international law, about being part of the community of nations and not about being, the exception. The United States and Israel are the exception to international laws, and specifically when it concerns human rights. I mean, these are the very basic, the right to life. So I think it's something that, we should be concerned about.
Sure.
Internationally, everyone should be concerned about, but specifically as Americans that are trying to show a different image to the international community,
right.
And that no one is above the law.
I wonder
that we want to cooperate.
I wonder about, we have just a little while left, the power of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee in Congress. They seem to have had tremendous power over members of Congress. I wonder if you see any leadership in Congress that might be supportive of calling for support of a UN investigation and possibly, doing something about violations of American law.
Well, we did see that some American congressmen did go over to Gaza, and Congressman Keith Ellison and Congressman Brian Baird did pay a visit to Gaza, and they are speaking out about the need to do something to address the. They focused a lot on the humanitarian situation that exists in Gaza, but I also think that their eyes were open to, right, to something much larger. And what is needed is U.S. citizen action on this. You mentioned that AIPAC, the Israel lobby, is very strong on Capitol Hill, and there really isn't a counter to AIPAC on Capitol Hill. But that doesn't mean that we belittle the power of the average American citizen to make a difference, to let your congressman or congresswoman, elected representative, know what you think. And this is something that I was at a presentation by Congressman Keith and Baird, or Ellison and Baird, a couple of weeks ago, and that's something they said. They said, let us hear what you think, get in contact with your congresspeople, because a lot of times we do know what's going on, or we have some information, but we need you to make us act on this information. And so it's up to the average American citizen to really educate themselves, and I hope that they will read our report or other reports that are coming out and contact the members of Congress about the importance of not being silent, violations of human rights, and more specifically about American support, weapons, and other financial assistance being used to violate human rights abroad.
Well, thank you very much for being with us about talking about making change. A website people can go to for more information about the National Lawyers Guild or the report that was issued.
www.nlg.org.
Pretty simple, nlg.org. Hawaida Araf, thank you very much. Must have been quite an interesting time being there. And we'll see what happens from here, what Israel does, what the United States does. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Bert Cohen here. You've been listening to Portside. And it's important that we have the rule of law and the people know their rights.
This is a public service announcement. With guitar! Know your rights! All three of them! Number one, you have the rights not to be killed. Murder is a crime. Listen.
Know your rights. Thanks for listening to Portside. Bert Cohen here.